From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be joined by Peter Greenwald and Suzanne Fletcher, who will provide an update on screening for breast cancer. Then, Sheila Hicks, Regina Hagerman, and Brady Case will join us to talk about the lack of health insurance among many healthcare workers. And later in the show, our editorial piece will expand the comparison of health insurance in the U.S. to the situation in the other developed countries. But first, a news update from the world of public health. The Associated Press reports a new backyard device designed to kill ticks on the backs of mice could prove a powerful weapon against Lyme disease. It consists of bait boxes designed to lure the rodents that harbor the Lyme disease bacteria. As mice pass through the boxes, which are supposed to be pet-proof and child-proof, an oily wick coats their shoulders with fipronil, a potent tick-killing compound also used to protect dogs and cats. The bait boxes must be installed and replaced periodically by trained exterminators at a cost of $300 to $600 per year. The boxes are spaced along the edge of yards where ticks and the mice and chipmunks on which the ticks feed lurk among brush and trees. A 10-acre test plot where 125 boxes were spread had 96% fewer ticks after 2 years. It's not yet known whether the boxes reduce Lyme disease in people. Cases of Lyme disease, named for the Connecticut town where it was discovered in 1977, have been rising in the Northeast, where it's most common. In the year 2000, nearly 18,000 U.S. cases were reported. Other important measures to prevent Lyme disease include clearing brush, using insect repellent, which also works in deterring ticks, and showering after being outdoors. A study in the journal Pediatrics compared outcomes and resources used to prevent infant mortality in the U.S., Britain, Canada, and Australia. The study found that, adjusting for the number of births, the U.S. employed twice as many neonatal intensive care specialists compared to the other countries and maintained 40% more neonatal intensive care beds than Canada and Australia, and four times more than Britain. But for babies with low birth weight, mortality rates were about the same among the four countries, even for infants weighing less than 2.5 pounds. The infant mortality rate in the U.S. is higher than in any of the other countries because a larger number of low-weight babies are born, and because infants with a normal birth weight have a higher mortality rate in the United States. If the U.S. achieved Canada's survival rate, almost 3,000 more babies would survive each year, and even more would survive if we could equal Australia, which performed best among the four countries. Dr. Lindsay Thompson, the lead author, pointed out that Australia, Canada, and Britain provide universal health insurance, while in the U.S., only 86% of children and 78% of women had health insurance. Australia, Canada, and Britain provide free family planning advice and free prenatal and perinatal care. One hopeful sign is that the rate of teenage pregnancy and unintended pregnancy in the U.S. has been improving for the last 3 years. However, the U.S. still has far higher rates of both teen pregnancy and unintended pregnancy than the other three countries in the study, as well as most of Europe. Reuben King Shaw, an administrator at the federal agency that oversees the Medicaid program, testified at a Senate hearing this month that only 20% of the children insured through the Medicaid program are getting screened to determine if they have elevated levels of lead in their bloodstream. This has made the goal of eradicating lead poisoning by the year 2010 quite unlikely. Elevated blood levels of lead have been shown to retard growth and lower intelligence. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that around the time of the child's first and second birthdays, children should have a blood test to identify if there is an elevated blood lead level. The Medicaid program provides care for many poor families who don't have other insurance coverage. It adopted that recommendation as a requirement and pays for the screenings and any diagnostic or treatment services required for children found to have elevated levels. And it also pays for a one-time investigation to find the source of the lead. But Mr. Shaw noted that Medicaid has no way to ensure that the tests are performed. The only available enforcement mechanism is to suspend Medicaid payments to healthcare providers who do not perform the screenings. But doing so might further impede access to care, already a major problem for individuals insured through Medicaid. The CDC estimates that 500,000 to 700,000 children have blood lead levels above the recommended threshold. Many of them live in older, poorer neighborhoods where housing still contains lead paint. Today's show, as well as the next airing of Public Health Radio, will address breast cancer. Next month, we'll be looking at possible environmental causes of breast cancer. Today, we'll look at breast cancer screening. What is known, what controversies have developed in the field, and what are the likely future directions in the early detection of breast cancer? Our guests today are Peter Greenwald and Suzanne Fletcher. After completing training programs and certification in both internal medicine and preventive medicine, Peter Greenwald earned his doctorate in public health at the Harvard School of Public Health, where his research focused on prostate cancer. Since then, his research work relates to human cancer prevention trials, cancer epidemiology, and cancer control. Dr. Greenwald is author or co-author of about 250 scientific papers. At the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Greenwald established the Division of Cancer Prevention, of which he's currently the director. Among his responsibilities is the development and conduct of cancer prevention clinical trials. He created the Community Clinical Oncology Program to reach out to doctors who are not working at research centers and help them connect their patients to cancer research studies. He has worked to expand research in tobacco, nutrition, biomarkers, and in the early detection of cancer, which is the topic of today's show. Suzanne Fletcher received her medical training at Harvard and Stanford medical schools and advanced training in public health at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. She served on the faculty at the University of North Carolina for several years and returned to Harvard Medical School in 1994. She served as editor of the Annals of Internal Medicine from 1990 to 1993 and also on the editorial boards of several other leading medical journals. In addition to her medical practice at Harvard Medical School, she has served on the Executive Committee of the Institute of Medicine and on the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. At the National Cancer Institute, she serves on their Board of Scientific Advisors. She has received teaching awards at Harvard Medical School, has authored several hundred publications, focusing especially on the practice of general internal medicine and on the prevention of breast cancer. Dr. Fletcher has been the principal investigator on several major research grants. The primary focus of her research has been the early detection and prevention of breast cancer. Suzanne Fletcher and Peter Greenwald, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a couple months ago on Public Health Radio, we discussed some of the theory behind cancer screening as it applies to prostate cancer. And we were discussing then that one of the key factors that makes screening effective is if the disease you're screening for is common in the population that you're interested in. So can we talk about that in the case of breast cancer?
Yes. We expect this year in the United States nearly 204,000 women will develop breast cancer, and nearly 40,000 will die from it. Breast cancer increases as a woman gets older. For example, from age 40 to about age 50, during that period, one out of 67 women will develop breast cancer. In the next 10 years, from 50 to 60, one out of 35 will develop breast cancer. So the frequency increases with age. Close to half of breast cancer occurs after age 65.
Breast cancer is unique. Breast cancer, more than just being the most common cancer, which it is for women, it involves a very important emotional and sexual part of the body. And so there's a lot of emotion around breast cancer. There have been lots of studies showing that women really fear this, that they overestimate their risk of cancer, and they overestimate their risk of dying of breast cancer.
Now, traditionally, three measures have been used to screen for breast cancer. Can you describe the three measures?
Well, first of all, is mammography, which is an X-ray of the breast. And probably the most scientific work has been done on mammography. Then there is the examination by a healthcare professional, a breast exam. And finally, the woman herself can do breast self-examination. It's probably the only non-skin cancer that the patient can actually do the test herself.
For those three measures we talked about, the self-exam, annual exam by a professional, and then mammography, can you describe what five or six major consensus panels have recommended?
The most recent recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force was to begin mammography at age 40. They were uncertain about the benefit of clinical breast examination and breast self-examination. The Canadian Task Force looked very closely at breast self-examination and recently, within the past year, came out with a recommendation against teaching it because they said the most recent evidence suggests that it doesn't protect women, but women feel things and then they have to go to the doctor and get it checked, and they have a lot more procedures than if they hadn't carried out breast self-exam.
And what about groups in Europe? Have they taken positions on this?
Yes. Generally, most of the European countries recommend mammography beginning at age 50 rather than 40. The reason for the difference is breast cancer is less common in the younger women, so there's less there to find. And also, it's more difficult to detect using mammography. For example, there are false negatives. A false negative is when a mammogram appears normal, even though breast cancer is present. And mammograms might miss perhaps 20% of breast cancers that are present at the time of screening. Well, younger women have more dense breasts, and it's easier to miss a cancer. There also are more false positives in younger women, and that's particularly if they've had prior biopsies and some scar tissue around. So the evidence is less strong for the younger women, but it becomes more clear when women reach their 50s.
I think this issue of false positives is an important thing for women to understand, too, because regardless of the screening test, no screening test is without some problems. And most women think about the problem of mammography, for instance, being the pain of the actual procedure, and some women worry about radiation exposure. And I must say, from everything that I've read and talked with the experts in that area, women should not worry about the radiation. But this issue of false positives that Dr. Greenwald mentioned is important, that they understand that that's not uncommon. If you look by mammogram, in other words, if you take 100 mammograms, about 11% of those will be read as abnormal enough so that something else has to be done. And almost all of those, the woman does not have cancer, and so they're false positive. However, if a woman keeps coming back year after year after year, this chance accumulates. And so after 10 mammograms, about half the women, it's been estimated, will have had experienced a false positive. So she should understand this. Lots of studies have been done showing that women get worried when they're told, you know, your mammogram wasn't quite normal. That's natural and understandable. But I think along with that, we have to help educate them to understand that in the vast majority of cases, this will not mean that she has cancer. And in the cases when she does, the whole idea is to have caught it early.
It seems that there's a cycle about the permeation of breast cancer screening into the media, the general conventional U.S. media. In 1997, issues centering around breast cancer screening got some public attention. And then again in winter of this year, and in the period, the 5 years or so between that, one didn't hear very much from the U.S. media. And during both of those times, there were relatively controversial statements coming out from different sources about the utility of breast cancer screening. Dr. Greenwald, can you describe what brought those controversies on and how the National Cancer Institute responded?
Yes, there were two different incidents, one in 1997 and one just recently. In 1997, the issue was focused on women in their 40s. There was agreement that mammography should be recommended for women 50 and over. The NIH ran a consensus conference, and the basic information was that there's some uncertainty for women in their 40s, and the consensus conference recommended that women consult with their physicians and make an informed decision in face of the some uncertainty that was present. There were others that objected to that, feeling that might affect reimbursement, for example, and felt strongly we should be recommending mammograms in that age group. So the result was that when there's controversy, it gets into the press, and it's important for women to understand there are some limitations. Mammography is not a perfect test. However, we do think it saves lives and it's useful. In this past year, two scientists from Denmark wrote a critique in a British medical journal called Lancet. This was a critique of the 7 trials showing benefits for mammograms. These two scientists felt that there were limitations in the trial that made it difficult to interpret the trial and thus made it less certain that mammography was really a useful test. Other groups now have looked at their critique and felt that they did not refute the evidence that mammography saves lives.
In that paper from Denmark you just referred to,
they didn't do any new study themselves. They were looking at all the old studies and criticizing them and picking at them and even discarding some of them because they felt there were just technical issues that made them weak. And I guess some of what they were saying, first of all, was convincing, but some of those studies are quite old, 15, 20 years old. Isn't it possible that back then screening may not have been as useful and maybe we have both improved screening techniques now and that we may have better treatment now and that now screening may be actually useful, whereas it may not have been then?
Yeah, I believe the critique did not provide sufficient evidence of limitations of those studies. In other words, it did not refute the evidence in those trials that mammography was useful. It is true that the trials were done from the 1960s through the 1980s, and we would not repeat the trial now because we would not randomize, that is, by a flip of the coin, ask some women not to have mammograms. There have been important trends since the time of those trials. There have clearly been improvements in therapy in all stages of breast cancer treatment. This is important because screening is only useful if you have a good therapy. There have been changes in the technique of mammography, some refinements. There also have been improvements in the technique of biopsy. Now there's something called a stereotactic biopsy, which means the doctor can put the needle exactly where he or she thinks it should go. The result of that is that women who might have been told to come back in 3 months or 6 months because of an uncertain lesion now have the biopsy right away because there's less discomfort with it. So there have been changes that could affect screening. We've had a time trend in the past 10 years or 11 years, there's been about a 13% reduction in the death rate from breast cancer. And through different types of modeling, looking at stage at diagnosis, we know that a portion of that decline is due to screening. So we have additional evidence now beyond the clinical trials that screening has benefits.
So to summarize, what recommendations do you end up giving? And I'd like you to separate out women under 50, women 50 to 70, and then as women are aging, what's your current recommendation about what age screening would no longer be reasonable or useful to do?
For women under 40, and I used to see such women who had real worries even in their 20s, if they didn't have a strong family history, I would try and reassure them. And in fact, I tried to figure out a way that would make sense to them, and giving them numbers often confused them. So finally, I went and looked up some data, and I said, look, a 70-year-old man, this is, has 5 times the chance of getting breast cancer in the next year as a 20-year-old woman. And they would look at me and say, but I've never heard of a man getting breast cancer. And I would say, exactly. Now go out and buckle your seatbelt. As you move on up into the 40s, the most important thing I try and get across to women is that as they get older, their breast cancer risk goes up. And that in the 40s, although you hear constantly this terrible number of 12% of women are going to get breast cancer, I always say if there are 1,000 women who turn 40 today, when they turn 50, 10 years from now, 15 will have developed invasive breast cancer. So let's get the risk right. And then we look at the evidence about screening. And by and large, I try and make clear that it is likely that over time, 2 to 4 of those 1,000 women will have been saved if they get regular screening. Most women in their 40s get screening. And the other piece of the information I try and give them is it's going to be likely, about 50-50, that you'll experience a false positive mammogram. So be ready for it. And in fact, we in our practice have developed a pamphlet to explain to women what that's all about. As I say, most women will go ahead and get it. In the 50s and 60s, I try and give them the updated information about it being more common, and most of those women as well get it. At the other end, we don't have much evidence after the age of 70, but given the evidence we do have, most groups have said if a woman's life expectancy is at least 10 years, she should continue to get mammography.
And what positions do you take on you doing a breast exam on the patient and on recommending her to do it herself, self-exam?
If I go ahead and conduct clinical breast exams, I've done a lot of work in that area, and I think the many of these trials that Dr. Greenwald has mentioned included clinical breast examinations. If a woman wants to practice breast self-examination, to me the most important thing is that she does that in addition to, not instead of, these other screening approaches. And I will refer her to programs that will teach her how to do this very well if she wants to do it.
In what directions is current research heading in the early detection of breast cancer?
In early detection, there's a focus in a couple of different areas. One is better imaging techniques. For example, a digital mammogram, which could be stored and retrieved electronically. It can be adjusted by the radiologist to possibly take into account problems with dense breasts and improve the reading. You can get a second opinion quickly over the telephone lines. So there's a potential benefit of other technologies, other screening techniques. There are methods called magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, and PET scanning. There's another very exciting area of research that's will take longer to reach to find out how useful it might be. And this is looking for markers of breast cancer in the blood or in the urine or in nipple aspirates. Basically, it's looking at the pattern of proteins in the blood to see whether we can distinguish cancer from precancer, from benign breast diseases, from normal. It's a very active area of research.
I just want to also stress how important the research is in better treatments. After all, the whole reason to screen when it first became popular was to catch it early enough so that the existing treatments could cure the disease. Well, if we improve treatments, they can cure it regardless of the stage of the disease, and that's extremely important.
Can you direct interested listeners to relevant websites to learn more about breast cancer and recommendations about early detection?
I think the best one, frankly, is CancerNet, which is run by the NCI. It has information for the lay public. It's just cancernet.nci.nih.gov.
Or you can just write cancer.gov.
Yes.
And get into the whole NCI website.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
You're welcome.
And hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we'll find out about the large number of healthcare workers who themselves have no health insurance coverage. And then later, in our opinion piece, we'll make the comparison between health insurance in the other developed countries to our system and learn about other concerned citizens in New York State and Vermont who are doing something about the problem and how to get involved yourself. So stay tuned. While it is a huge hardship for anyone to go without health insurance, it's particularly ironic when healthcare workers themselves lack insurance coverage. These individuals would not be able to receive the care they provide every day. To explore the magnitude of this problem, a group of investigators at Harvard Medical School explored this issue. On today's show, Brady Case, the lead investigator, joins us to discuss this article, which appeared in the March 2002 issue of the American Journal of Public Health. A little later, we'll be joined by Regina Hagerman and Sheila Hicks, two healthcare workers who themselves have had to face the problem of lack of health insurance coverage. Brady Case received his BA degree from Harvard University and also his medical degree from Harvard in June 2002. He has already been involved in the publication of several research papers, including the one we're discussing today. His activities have included participation in a health profession student group advocating for universal health care and participation in administering a Big Brother, Big Sister program. Brady Case, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you, Marvin.
I thought your study, just published in the American Journal of Public Health, was an important contribution to our understanding of who's left in this country without health insurance. Tell us about the methods you used to study health insurance coverage among healthcare workers.
Sure. We used what's called the Current Population Survey. It's conducted by the Census every year, and they survey about 150,000 U.S. residents, and they take all kinds of information from them, demographic information, occupational info, and health insurance status, as well as a lot of other stuff. And what we did is we looked at employees in physicians' offices and hospitals, nursing homes, and other health services settings, and the range of occupations that were represented there are a lot of the folks you'd think of as being medical workers, physicians, nurses, managers in healthcare, health aides. But we also included food service workers, building service workers, folks who work in laundries, clerical and administrative support. So we really captured essentially everyone who works for a healthcare employer.
And what were your findings in the most recent year?
The most recent year was 1998, and there we found that one out of every eight healthcare workers lacks medical insurance, which surprised us. We knew that the numbers were substantial, but we didn't know how substantial they would be. There were 1.36 million healthcare workers altogether in 1998 who were uninsured, and that represents a massive increase from a decade ago. We also found, looking at the children of healthcare workers, that 1 in 10 were uninsured, and that as a group, the children of healthcare workers represented about 10% of the uninsured children nationally.
Now, which groups of healthcare workers were least likely to have health insurance?
I should say straight away that the numbers have worsened for everyone, but some folks have faced worse coverage rates than others. In terms of occupation, health aides had the lowest rates of coverage, about 24%. In terms of settings, nursing homes had the worst coverage rates. About 1 in 5 nursing home personnel were uninsured in 1998.
And were there differences across races or ethnicity that you noted?
Yeah, there were. Black and Hispanic personnel were at least twice as likely as white personnel to lack insurance.
Do you know why that was? Does it depend on where they lived, or were they in jobs that had a higher likelihood of having providing no health insurance coverage?
I think the latter was the most important confounder there, that black and Hispanic personnel were most likely to be in the occupational groups and in the health settings, which, generally speaking, had the lowest insurance coverage rates.
And how about differences across the country? Which states tended to have the highest proportion of uninsured health workers?
Well, we looked at a number of the large states, and then we looked at regions. And Texas was the worst state by far among the major states in terms of states that had large numbers of healthcare workers. About 21.5% were uninsured in 1998, and that compares to 12.4% was the national average. Generally, the Southwest and the West Coast did poorly, and so did the Southeast. The states that looked the best were generally in the Midwest and New England. The Great Plains, in general, seemed to have the best numbers. What the census calls the west-north-central area, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, the Dakotas, Nebraska, and Kansas, had rates of about 7%.
Now, you also compared healthcare workers to the entire remainder of the labor force, all the other occupations
combined.
What did you find there?
So what we did was we just comparing healthcare workers to the rest of the working public, and this is under age 65. The proportion uninsured in 1998 was about 18%, which is, you know, higher than the average across the healthcare industry. What was interesting about that was that the change or the increase in the numbers uninsured was much more dramatic for healthcare workers than for workers in other industries. So whereas in healthcare the numbers uninsured went up about 84%, in other industries they increased about 38%. So everybody's been suffering over the past 10 years, and it's a surprise considering how well the economy's been doing in general. But healthcare workers, it looks like, have been in the middle of what seems to be a particularly dynamic sector in terms of changes in benefits.
Now, many of our listeners may not be aware of the tremendous amount of time and effort that goes into putting together a research paper for publication. Brady, you're a medical student. That means the demands on your time are already huge. How did you become aware of the problem of the uninsured in the U.S., and how did you come to feel so strongly about the problem that you decided to devote the time it took to get this study published?
Well, I think as a medical student, we start with the assumption that everybody who's sick is potentially a patient, and everybody who gets sick ought to receive the best care possible. It's just sort of the It's just it's the premise of medical education. So as a medical student, the idea that people are uninsured is particularly difficult to work with. It's difficult to accept. It sounds wrong. It sounds counterproductive in terms of maintaining the health of the community. So it's not hard to get a medical student riled up about uninsured people. In terms of my particular commitment to doing research, there isn't that much you can do when you're in medical school outside of the wards and outside of the medical community, it feels like. And to me, this was a way to make the most impact with what I had available.
At this point, I'd like to bring our other two guests into the conversation. Sheila Hicks received her high school diploma from Dorchester High School in Boston. She's worked her entire career as a nursing assistant, involved in nursing home care. For a number of years to the present, she has worked at the Sachem Skilled Nursing and Rehab Center. Regina Hagerman received her high school diploma in 1992. Over the last 15 years, she worked her way up to be an assistant manager at a Burger King, worked for 7 years in an auto supply store, and she herself provided care for both her parents at home during the late 1990s when both of them died of cancer. This experience motivated her to change careers and enter the field of personal care when her mom died in 1999. Since then, she has worked full-time as a personal care attendant, which she provides at the homes of elderly, disabled, and terminally ill patients. Through this period, she has also managed to raise a family of 5 children, and during this period, she was treated for cancer herself and is herself a cancer survivor. Regina Hagerman and Sheila Hicks, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Regina, you live and work near Chicago.
Yes, I do.
Tell us about your job.
I'm a homemaker, which I take care of seniors in their homes to keep them from going to nursing homes. I take care of them as far as getting them food, if they don't have any food. I help them with clothing, putting their clothes on. I help do the cleaning of their house, keeping the maintenance up on their house. Take them grocery shopping or take them shopping, whatever they would like to do. And we also take care of Alzheimer's patients and patients with Parkinson's and different type of illness, too.
How long have you been doing this kind of work?
I've been doing this type of work for 3 years now.
And about how many hours each week do you work?
37.
And you don't have health insurance?
No.
When was the last time you did have health insurance?
I haven't had health insurance until I changed into this job, doing the type of work that I do. I was working retail, and I did have health insurance then.
And you work privately, or you have an agency that
I have an agency that I work through, which is privately owned.
I see. Now, Sheila, you live near Boston, right?
Yes, I do, about 25 miles south of Boston.
I see. And what type of work do you do?
I'm a certified nursing assistant.
And do you work at people's homes, or you work in a nursing home?
Yes, I work in a nursing home. It's about 121, 123 patients there. Mostly, you know, difficult patients. We do have some Alzheimer's patients, some Tupi patients. Some are I won't say self-care, but maybe an assist with their daily skills.
And how long have you been doing that kind of work?
Well, I've been at this particular job for 28 years, and before that, maybe before I was married, I did it for a few years, and then I did it shortly after my first child was born. I did it part-time, and then after my second and third one came along, I stopped doing it until 28 years ago I went back.
And how many hours a week do you work right now?
Right now, I'm doing between 16 and 24. 16, as they say, on the books, because I recently cut down to the 16 hours.
I see. And they don't offer you health insurance at your job?
Well, not for 16 hours. Now it's 30 hours. I did have it for 24 hours because through the union, we got it grandfathered in for people who have been there since before 1999. We could have health insurance for 24 hours. But after doing this for so long, 24 hours got to be a little too much for me because of my age, too. I am going to be 59 shortly, and it's just kind of too much. So I had to cut down to 16. I do miss the money, but now going eventually, well, sometimes I pick up the extra 8 hours to make it 24, but that still doesn't entitle me to the insurance because I'm not on the books for 24.
So you've been without health insurance for how long?
Well, July it'll be a year and a half because what I did was I hooked on with Cobra, which is almost $300 a month, and it's too much money to keep doing. In July it'll run out, so then I will be without health insurance again. I did ask if I picked up the 24 again, could I get it, and they told me no, that was a one-time offer, and I dropped down to 16, so now I can't have it. I don't really know why, but I can't.
Do either of you have children below the age of 18?
Yes, I do.
I don't.
How old? You don't?
Uh-uh.
Sheila? So, Regina, how old are your kids?
13, 10, 9, 8, and 5.
Now, do your kids have health insurance?
Yes, they do. They have it through the state of Illinois,
but I
don't have it.
And now, for both of you, I assume that this is not a personal thing where your boss has it in for you, so they're not offering you health insurance. So there apparently are many other workers in your positions who also don't have health insurance. Is that the case?
Yes, it is. In my situation, it is.
Everyone where you work in
yes.
your position?
Yes.
Do either of you know if the managers at your workplace have health insurance coverage?
Yes, they do. At my job, they do.
Yes, my job, they do, too.
I assume that a lot of your patients are elderly, Regina?
Yes, they are. They're senior citizens.
Let's say that something bad happened to you, say a neurological illness or something, and you needed the kind of care that you give to your patients. Do you think you'd be able to afford it?
No. And I can speak from firsthand experience. I have ovarian cancer, and I needed someone to come and take care of me while I was down and take care of my children. And I had to actually leave my house and go to my godmother's house and let her take care of me because I couldn't get the services that I provide to my clients.
What if you had to have one of the beds and have people taking care of you at your facility? Would you be able to afford that care?
Well, no, I wouldn't because I wouldn't have any insurance. I mean, you know, once my Cobra runs out in July, I'm going to be, you know, up the creek without a paddle. I'm not going to have any insurance either. So that's going to be kind of tough. I don't know how I'm going to do it. My other option is to go 30 hours, which my company will offer. Well, they say 30, but it's actually 32 because a shift is 8 hours. I doubt that I would get permanently a shift every night, 3 to 9. So I could get it sometimes. So I would most probably have to go to 32 hours. And, you know, at my age, I can't do 32 hours in a nursing home. I just cannot. My body shows what I've been doing, as my doctor says to me.
So, Regina, tell me, have you ever had to go without medical care that you thought you needed, or?
Yes. I had to go all the way to Cook County Hospital and sit for days and hours just to be seen with bleeding that I lost a lot of blood because I had to sit there and wait because I had to go to Cook County Hospital. As you know, Cook County is a hospital that takes care of people that doesn't have insurance. But the price you have to pay for that is you have to sit there. You'd be almost literally dead by the time they get to you.
So this happened back when before you qualified for Medicaid, I guess?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you end up, that was when you found out that you had a cancerous tumor?
Yes, this was September 1st of 99.
I see. And when did you finally get health insurance?
I finally got health insurance January 1st of 2001.
Oh, much later.
Yes, much, much later.
So did you end up with big medical bills that were
yes.
hard to pay?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I have a bill for South Suburban Hospital that I went to because I had passed out at my job and they had to send me to the closest hospital. They couldn't take me to Cook County. And I'm looking at a $25,000 bill from them that I cannot afford to pay. That's on my credit report. That's making my ratings for me to refinance my house much harder for me to do. Also, I went to St. James before that. Before I got the medical card, and I'm paying $13,000 to them for a laparoscopic surgery that they had to do to actually find out how progress the cancer had gotten. So, I mean, it's been an uphill battle for me.
as far as my health insurance is concerned. That's a big issue of mine.
Do you know how long you're going to have Medicaid coverage, or do you think you might leave and lose that again?
Yes, I probably will be losing that because I'm on a 6-month spend down.
Oh.
My kids are on it till they're 18, or until my income changed. But with me, I'm on a spend down. Every 6 months on, 6 months off.
So half the year you spend without any insurance
with
coverage?
With any insurance at all.
How do you decide which half?
I can't. It depends on if when I, okay, like I got it January 2000. I had it for my surgery. I'm off of it now. Probably in July, June or July, I'll probably get it back again. But that's not guaranteed.
Sheila, what about you? Have you ever had to go without care that you felt you needed?
Yeah, once I did. I didn't have insurance after I cut down those 32 hours, and I was having bad headaches, and I had to see a neurologist. And when I did, he wanted to do MRI or CAT scan, and you know I didn't have the money to pay it, and I just couldn't afford to have it done, so I didn't. But I think that was the only significant thing.
Do you worry about the problem?
Well, yeah, I'm already beginning to, you know, to worry about, you know, July's coming. It's going to creep up, and I'm going to be getting a letter from Cobra saying I'm no longer eligible. And, you know, I don't even think my company would be willing to let me keep paying. Not that paying almost the $300, you know, was easy. It's very difficult. But, yeah, I'm worried. I don't know what I'm going to do. I really don't know what I'm going to do, because I'm going to be out of insurance, because I can't pick up 32 hours again. I know that. And I'm just going to have to go without it come the end of July, because, like I say, you're only eligible for that for 18 months, and then you can't get it anymore. So I do worry about it. I don't know what I'm going to do.
I was watching an edition of the primetime news show on ABC. It's called 2020. And they ran a brief segment on what happens to people who don't have health insurance coverage. Now, they ran that segment because there was an international report which received wide press coverage. And that report noted that every other developed country, from Japan, Australia, Canada, all of Europe, every one of those countries provide health insurance to all their citizens, regardless of whether they work, regardless of how many hours a week they work, or it doesn't matter if they're poor or rich or what, everybody gets health insurance. And the report pointed out that the United States was all alone in allowing so many people to go without health insurance. Anyway, John Stossel, who is the commentator, pointed out that everybody thinks it's such a big problem, but really it's not a big problem, because there's no emergency department or hospital in the country that turns away people just because they don't have health insurance. So not having health insurance is not such a big problem. What do you think about what John Stossel said, both of you?
I think that's a big lie. I know for a fact that's a big lie, and that's not true. Here in the state of Illinois, if you don't have any health insurance, they would ship you out to Cook County Hospital or to Oak Forest Hospital, and they also would, if you don't have any insurance, you have terribly, terribly bad, they would take hours and hours to see you, and that's including with the medical card. Because they feel as though they're not going to get paid. So that's a big lie.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I think going to the emergency room is just what that says. It's an emergency. And, I mean, some things that are deadly are not really an emergency. I mean, you can be having a very fast or slow heartbeat, and you can feel it, and you may have to go to the emergency room, and you may need a nitro patch. Well, they may give you one, put it on you, and then they're going to say follow up with your doctor. They all say that, whether
they
it's for
be.
A sore throat or whatever.
They
follow
be.
Up with your doctor.
Because
well, what do you do if you don't have a doctor?
Right.
Where's the continuity of care? There isn't any. What about maybe a lump on your breast that one doctor in the emergency room says, oh, you came here for that? That's a little cyst. Well, you know, how do you know it's a cyst? But if I had my own doctor would say, well, let's check it out. Let's see if it's a cyst. Let's give you an ultrasound.
Right.
Let's do something else.
Right.
I mean, you can't tell me that, you know, going to the emergency room is going to solve the problem. It's
yes.
not. We can tell John Stossel to go to the emergency room next time.
And make sure he don't take his high shot insurance policy when he go.
Mhm. Mhm.
Go with no insurance and see exactly what we go through.
Right. Right.
Don't take his Blue Cross and Blue Shield or that other high price insurance policy he got and see what happens to him.
Right. I mean, you know, the other countries aren't like that. I mean, I'm sure they have their emergency rooms too, but like I say, I think it's just for an emergency. I mean, to go there for good care, for someone who's going to follow through with you, do tests with you, you know, you're not going to get that there because the emergency rooms, I don't believe, are set up for that. They're set up for people coming in who have an emergency, accidents and things like that, or heart attacks, but not to really go kind of give the proper care that you're going to need and the follow-through either.
Brady, you wanted to comment on the issue of quality of care.
The medical literature is unambiguous about this. Lack of health insurance is a serious health risk. A recent study in JAMA found that death rates are 25% higher among the uninsured than among comparable Americans. Even the specific proposition that uninsured are treated like everyone else in an emergency room is false. If you look at people who arrive in ERs with serious symptoms, people who we would call medically unstable, uninsured patients are half as likely to be treated as the insured. And when they are treated, the uninsured are over twice as likely to suffer from an adverse event due to negligence. During an emergency, the uninsured are second-class patients.
Well, Brady Case, Regina Hagerman, and Sheila Hicks, thanks for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Okay.
Thank you.
Orvin, thank you very much.
Next, an opinion piece comparing health insurance in the U.S. to other developed countries. And we'll find out what local organizations in New York State and Vermont are doing to promote useful change. In all the other developed countries, providing health security to every citizen is as basic a responsibility of government as creating a transportation system that will allow commerce to take place, as providing some degree of security in old age, as keeping the food supply safe. On today's show, we learn that one out of every eight healthcare workers in the U.S. has no health insurance coverage. They are not alone. About 41 million Americans have no insurance coverage, and millions more have policies with massive deductibles or other gross deficiencies. It should make no more sense to leave 41 million people out of our healthcare system than to propose that we not protect and defend Florida or Hawaii from military attack because it's too expensive or inconvenient. The dysfunctional healthcare system in the U.S. is viewed as extreme in every one of the other 25 developed countries. From France to Finland, from Australia to Canada, there are no exceptions. There is no major political party in any developed country which supports scrapping their system in favor of our model. Those of us who work in the field of healthcare have all seen the consequences. We have seen uninsured people brought to emergency departments after suffering a paralyzing stroke. We found out that they were unable to afford the care that might have prevented the stroke. Then, after the stroke occurs, they are considered disabled and, after depleting their savings, will qualify for insurance through the government's Medicaid and Medicare programs. After failing to provide the relatively inexpensive cost of high blood pressure treatment, the taxpayers are then footing a huge bill for expensive nursing home care. Despite excluding so many people from our system, healthcare costs in the U.S. are unusually high. On a per capita basis, we pay nearly double what all the other developed countries pay for comprehensive medical care systems that serve their entire populations. None of the nations with national health insurance pay even half as much as we do on administration. And they don't tolerate the bureaucratic intrusions into clinical care that have become routine in the U.S. The major contributor to the high cost in the United States is the administrative burden imposed by insurers. These insurance companies create a miasma of bureaucratic burden in which hospitals, doctors' offices, all health providers, and the insurance companies themselves are mired. This situation has already lasted too long. But now, with rapidly rising health care premiums and an economy in recession, things will likely get much worse in the next few years. Having so many people without health insurance and having such high costs are not the only dysfunctional features of the U.S. healthcare system. Let's look at some other features that are unique to the U.S. Only in the U.S., individuals stay on welfare because the jobs they look into don't offer health insurance. And only in the U.S., small business owners are forced to pay far higher premiums than large businesses pay for the same insurance coverage. Only in the U.S., employees are discouraged from leaving a large company to start a new enterprise because of the issue of health insurance. Only in the U.S. are businesses which offer health coverage penalized when they find it difficult to compete with a business down the road which elects not to provide coverage. In the U.S., nearly half the bankruptcies in the country are brought on by medical debt. This situation is unheard of in all the other developed countries. Only here in the U.S., individuals are reluctant to change jobs or switch insurers because they know that all pre-existing conditions will not be covered by the new insurance company. When businesses are forced to downsize or close, the loss of employment is unfortunate for both the business owner and employees alike. But only in the U.S. does this loss of employment also mean a loss of health insurance coverage. Often after losing jobs, people develop not only stress and depression, but they are more likely to develop a variety of medical ailments as well. This then constitutes a triple blow: deterioration of health, loss of job, and because of lack of health insurance, accumulating medical debt. In the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, we saw how Americans cared about so many others they'd never met before. I ask all listeners to take on the civic duty of working to make our country a healthier, kinder place. Act to help your neighbors and act to benefit your family. Ordinary citizens in New York State and Vermont are now working to create the changes we and our neighbors need in health care. In a minute, I will let you know how to contact organizations which are working on this issue. So get out your pens and pencils now. Citizen Action and Vermont Healthcare for All are actively working for the creation of a publicly financed state insurance fund which would fully insure all medically necessary care. In this system, doctors, hospitals, and nursing homes would remain in the private sector and receive reimbursement from the insurance fund for the care they provide. Such a system would allow less than 4% to be expended on administration and virtually all effort to go toward patient care. For businesses, for workers, those who are or will be patients, and for those of us in the health professions, the benefits are great. For those of you who live in Eastern New York, contact Citizen Action at 465-4600. Its website is citizenactionny.org. For Vermonters, contact Healthcare for All at 802-224-9037 or email Dr. Deborah Richter at Dr. Deb Vermont, that's DREBVT @AOL.com. In Montpelier, Vermont, there will be a rally for universal health care at the state capitol at noon on Saturday, September 28th. Set aside the date now. Well, that's it for today's show. Next month, we'll be discussing environmental exposures that may lead to breast cancer. So join us again then for the next airing of Public Health Radio.